This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today, Colleen Connell, the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Illinois. It's actually the first time the City Club has ever had a representative of the ACLU speak to our group. And she said that Donald Trump, President Trump, was most responsible for her being invited. In fact, she said President Trump has been very good for the ACLU. Their membership since November 9th has increased in Illinois from 20,000 to 60,000, and they've raised three times the amount of funds this year than they did last year at a separate time. She feels that Trump and his administration is a threat to our democracy, to the laws of the land, and the norms of our democratic process. She castigated him for attacking the integrity of the electoral process, dismissing Russian threats to our election system, denigrating our intelligence agencies, and condemning the press as an enemy of the people. She focused most of her remarks on the appointment of Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions as leader of the Department of Justice and the fact that the Trump administration may not push for a consent decree vis-a-vis the Chicago Police Department. Colleen Connell felt that the police department deserves meaningful oversight, better trained officers, an ending of the code of silence, an ending to Laquan McDonald situations, and a more representative labor contract with the citizens of Chicago. She felt that all of this is necessary to preserve our liberties and our union.
Good afternoon. Thank you for that lovely reception and for inviting me to speak to the City Club of Chicago. I was thrilled to get this invitation. This is the first time, as far as I know, that anyone from the ACLU has ever been invited to speak at the City Club. So much as I'd like to think it's all about me, I need to give pause at the top of these remarks and express my appreciation to the person most responsible for this invitation, Donald Trump. I am sure that much to his chagrin, and he probably completely inadvertent, Donald Trump has been very good to the ACLU. Very good. In just a few short months, we have gone from 20,000 members in Illinois, as Jay indicated when I was invited to speak, to now more than 60,000 paid members in Illinois. And it gets better. We have 100,000 people in Illinois who have joined our electronic action network to take action. So all of our elected members of Congress and the General Assembly will be hearing from the ACLU. So anyway, it's really, truly wonderful to be here. And so I thank you so much for the invitation. But I think that, you know, to go from a little bit of levity to the seriousness that we find ourselves in, a very serious situation, we really do look at the outpouring of support for the ACLU as a public recognition of a very grim reality. And that reality is that Donald Trump, in all likelihood, presents an existential threat to our democracy. He is reckless. And unfortunately, he is at best constitutionally ignorant and probably at worst disrespectful, not just of the laws of the land, but of the norms of democracy that in large part are, I think, the reason that we have been a successful democracy for more than 200 years. Just let me give you a few examples. He has attacked, as probably everybody here is aware, the integrity of our electoral process, claiming without any facts whatsoever that there were more than 3 million illegal voters. And while trumpeting these delusions, he dismisses the consensus of our intelligence agencies that the Russians unequivocally and undoubtedly interfered with the 2016 election. Perhaps more concerning is the fact that he is disrupting efforts both by Congress and the intelligence agencies, to determine whether people affiliated with him or his campaign were complicitous in the Russian meddling with our electoral systems. And while throwing out lies about former President Obama and former National Security Director Susan Rice, Trump continually condemns the press as the enemies of the people, and he lambasts the press whenever it engages in fact-based journalism. He considers that the fake news. His successive bans on travelers and refugees from predominantly Muslim countries reeked of anti-Muslim bias. In fact, that's why the courts enjoined those bans. And now he has the audacity to justify a military attack on Syria as motivated by the very human concern of the death of those beautiful Syrian children, the same children to whom he cruelly refuses to offer sanctuary. He challenges the independence of our judiciary, that bedrock check on abuses of governmental power. Faced with the judicial repudiation of that ill-conceived first travel ban, he took to Twitter to declare that judges were endangering American lives and property. And yet, he delayed introducing his second travel ban so that he could enjoy a few days of good press after his first address to Congress. The list goes on. But perhaps the most insidious effort of Donald Trump to undermine basic civil liberties in this country can be seen with his nomination of Jeff Sessions as the Attorney General of the United States. Jeff Beauregard Sessions, a man who was considered unfit in 1986 to serve as a federal judge because of his documented racial animus, now leads the Department of Justice. With Jeff Sessions at its helm, the department is fast retreating from its historic obligation to defend the Constitution and the rule of law. Just a few short weeks ago, Sessions acted to withdraw the federal guidance informing public schools of their obligation to afford students who are transgender equal rights. That guidance was issued last year after school districts around the nation, including several here in Illinois, asked the federal government for guidance and best practices for accommodating students who are transgender. Sessions also is the architect of the policy seeking to deport more than 11 million undocumented people, many of them women and children. We already are seeing stepped-up raids in communities across the country, including in the Chicago area. And those raids include the detention of young people who have been brought to the United States as children and who had gained relief from deportation under the DACA program. And I'm not done yet about Jeff Sessions. He has abandoned, but I will get you up by 1:15. He has abandoned the litigation aimed at challenging voter restrictions in Texas, including a voter ID law that targeted people of color, older voters, and those likely to vote Democratic. Rather than challenge these bald partisan efforts to restrict the right to vote, Jeff Sessions walked away. However, the ACLU of Texas will continue that litigation. Tragically, Sessions' hostility to civil rights and civil liberties will be evidenced most harshly in the area of law enforcement, an issue of extraordinary importance here in Chicago, and an issue on which I'd like to devote the rest of my remarks. On March 31st, Jeff Sessions announced that the Department of Justice was stepping back from its efforts to reform problematic law enforcement agencies, like its letter of intent with Chicago to enter into a consent decree with federal judicial oversight. Oversight that is necessary to reform the Chicago Police Department. With this decision, Jeff Sessions dismissed a thorough Department of Justice investigation of the Chicago Police Department that had extended more than a year and that had just been completed on January 13th of 2017, a week before the inauguration. The DOJ attorneys who conducted that investigation were consummate professionals. Many of them were career lawyers at the Department of Justice. They reviewed tens of thousands of pages of documents, including the Chicago Police Department's databases and investigatory files. They interviewed hundreds of people, including countless police officers, advocates like the ACLU, and scores of community members. The DOJ, in its investigative report, linked the violence that's being experienced by Chicago neighborhoods, particularly on the south and west side, to the lack of trust between the Chicago Police Department and the people it serves. Indeed, the Department of Justice concluded that CPD is badly broken. It is broken and compromised by ineffective systems that allow CPD officers who violate the law to escape any accountability and any oversight that leads to meaningful reform. The Department of Justice concluded specifically that this breach of trust has in turn eroded the Chicago Police Department's ability to effectively prevent crime, to investigate crime, and to solve crime. In other words, trust and effectiveness in combating violent crime are inextricably linked. The Department of Justice concluded that that broken system of policing fails everybody, including everyone in this room. It fails people in communities, particularly, again, on the south and west side, minority communities. It fails the officers themselves, and it fails the taxpayers of the city. DOJ revealed a police department that uses harsh and unfair policing tactics, including unreasonable force, disproportionately and continually deployed against minority communities here in Chicago. A few statistics will illustrate the validity of this conclusion. For those of you, and I think it's many of you, perhaps most of you, who live in the city of Chicago, you know that blacks, Latinos, and whites make up approximately equal thirds of the city's population. Raw statistics show that CPD uses force almost 10 times more often against blacks than it does whites. The ACLU statistics on stop and frisk, which you've read about in the newspaper a lot over the last couple of years, document a similar disparity. In the summer of 2014, so almost 3 years ago, 72% of the stops and frisks were conducted against African Americans. 17% were conducted against Hispanics, 5% against whites. More recent data, collected under the agreement that the ACLU negotiated with the city and Chicago Police Department, as well as the requirements of a new state law, also show concrete and continuing disparities in the enforcement of the law. Many police stops of African Americans and Latinos continue to lack legal justification under the Fourth Amendment, and of those frisked, officers are far more likely to find contraband in whites who have been stopped than in either African Americans or Latinos. The flaws don't stop there. The Department of Justice also documented recurring, unaddressed, racially discriminatory conduct by officers, again, against the communities that they have sworn to protect. Residents of black neighborhoods reported, quote, treatment so demeaning that they felt inhumanized. As the Department of Justice explained, consistent with our reports, our investigation found that there was a recurring portrayal by some Chicago police officers of the residents of challenged neighborhoods, who are mostly black, as animals or subhuman. This is 2017. One CPD officer himself reported to the Department of Justice that officers in his district come to work every day, quote, like it's a safari. A theme long with a long history here in Chicago, and one symbolized by a photo of white police officers squatting over a black man posing as a dead deer. Complaints about racially discriminatory conduct by CPD officers, by and large, are not adequately addressed because there is no meaningful oversight in the Chicago Police Department. Again, the Department of Justice's review of the CPD's own data underscore this. Over a period of a little bit more than 4 years, that data showed 980 police misconduct complaints that were coded as discriminatory verbal abuse on the basis of either race or ethnicity. Only 13 of those complaints, a measly 1.3%, were sustained. The Department of Justice also found that 354 of those complaints involved the use of the N-word or one of its variations. Only 4 of those complaints, 1.1%, were sustained. It's not limited to direct interactions between the police and the communities they serve. Abuses on social media also abound and were documented in the Department of Justice report. Several Chicago police officers posted social media posts containing disparaging remarks about minorities, including Arabs and Muslims. Some posts referred to Muslims as, quote, 7th-century goat herders, and others made other anti-Islamic statements, including a picture with a caption saying, the only good Muslim is a dead Muslim. Although we here on the north side of Chicago, here in River North, or on Michigan Avenue or Lincoln Park, do not often see this type of policing, something the Department of Justice also notes in its report. The abuses that I've described are how certain neighborhoods in our city experience policing on a daily basis. A daily basis. Overall, taking into account everything it reviewed in its long investigation, the Department of Justice found a department that was lacking in terms of meaningful training of officers who are tasked with patrolling our city. The department detailed a failed supervisory system where officers have no meaningful oversight and little guidance or support from supervisory personnel. And the report demonstrated that Chicago police officers are permitted, even encouraged, to lie in order to cover up the misuse of authority or force, even deadly force. As the Chicago Tribune noted last Thursday in its editorial about yet another police officer who was given preferential treatment by his own force, this is the reason that the Department of Justice came in here to investigate our department. For many of us, these findings were not surprising. And I need to go back no further in time than the example that I know you're all familiar with, which is the public narrative that was pushed by the police and the mayor and the city of Chicago about the shooting death of Laquan McDonald. While I'm sure that we all have seen that video more times than we could actually count, and we understand now how that young life was taken, it's important to recall that the official CPD story, signed off by everyone at the scene of the crime and in the chain of command, was that Laquan McDonald had threatened officers and had been shot only 2 or 3 times. As the video documents, and as the city itself knew because they settled the lawsuit, or they settled in short of a lawsuit, Laquan McDonald was walking away from the police when he was shot 16 times. The Laquan McDonald shooting may have been the catalyst, and a much needed one, for the Department of Justice investigation, but it was not the only incident of excessive force documented by the Department of Justice. Far from it. The DOJ also documented numerous uses of force, including use of force against children and people suffering from mental illness. To be clear, the system is broken for everyone. Residents of Chicago do not get the policing that they deserve and that they need. Police response times in communities of color are too long. Even when residents call to report violence or open-air drug markets, these communities are not served by the police, who appear far more often as occupiers than sworn officers committed to protect and serve. The system is broken for all taxpayers. On average, over the past 10 years, the city of Chicago taxpayers pay out more than $1 million each week to settle lawsuits related to improper use of force or other improper conduct by the Chicago police officers. You can do the math. 52 weeks times 10 times $1 million is more than $500 million. That's real money. But that money isn't as important as the lives that have been lost or the lives that have been inalterably changed by the Chicago Police Department. And perhaps most sadly, the Department of Justice found that the system is broken for the officers themselves. We asked Chicago police officers, all police officers for that matter, to do a very difficult job. They often meet people on a bad day, maybe the worst day in that person's life. Yet we as a society, we as a city, do very little to support our police officers. The CPD Employee Assistance Program, designed to help officers struggling with emotional and substance abuse issues, is chronically understaffed and under-resourced. For the nearly 13,500 officers on the force, Chicago Police Department has only three clinicians on staff at the time the Department of Justice report was issued. The results, then, are predictable and tragic. The suicide rate for CPD officers is more than 60% higher than the national average for police officers. Put another way, more Chicago police officers die of suicide than in the line of duty. So you can see how this system is badly broken. And again, going back to the Department of Justice report, this broken system has resulted in a wall of mistrust between the police and the communities they serve. But most acutely, we see the problems in communities of color. As the DOJ report made clear, and as we have seen in other cities, the only way to assure real reform is through a consent decree, a court-approved, court-monitored process that would not give elected officials any ability to resist reform. A court-overseen system of transparency, accountability, and real reform. Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions had the ability and the opportunity to take the Department of Justice report and the letter of intent that the city of Chicago signed to negotiate a consent decree. Such a decree would have been the first step in bringing real reform, real change to this broken police system. But Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions have walked away from that promise of reform, and they have made the reform process much more difficult. Just days after he became Attorney General, Sessions told a press conference that he was not inclined to support a consent decree for Chicago. Asked about the damning report that you've just heard about, Sessions reluctantly admitted that he had not even read it, and yet he's walking away from it. This willful ignorance on the part of Jeff Sessions cannot be an excuse to delay the work of real reform in the city of Chicago and its police department. The problems of our policing are costing money and lives on our streets on a daily basis. So what do we do? This is why I was really so delighted to get this invitation. We need everyone in this room and everyone you know to get behind the process of real reform. What that translates into in human terms is I need each of you today to talk to and put pressure on our city officials, the mayor, the aldermen, the members of the police department, the leadership of the Chicago Police Department, to agree to execute and proceed for real meaningful reform. Now, the mayor's task force and the Department of Justice report both laid out in quite specific detail the reforms that were needed to address the use of force, to improve training, to actually assure supervision, and to make services to the police officers better and more comprehensive. But reports and plans are not enough. We need action. We need your action, and we need your continued support, not just of the ACLU, not just of Shriver Center, not just of BPI and our other allies in the advocacy community who are working for police reform. The ACLU and other advocates are going to weigh all options, including litigation, grassroots advocacy, and legislative change. We plan to step in and take the place of the Department of Justice now that Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump have shown that they are unwilling to enforce the law of the land equally and to assure real police reform. And we really need your help to get that accomplished. Our second ask is a little bit more specific, but it also includes involving an increasing citizen pressure on the city and the city council to reform police union contracts, contracts that are up for renewal in the very near future. These contracts make the code of silence actual public policy. These contracts have specific provisions that make it very difficult, if not impossible, to identify police misconduct and to discipline it. This code of silence also makes it too easy for officers to lie, making misconduct difficult to investigate and very difficult to reform. The provisions of the Chicago Police Department contract supported, facilitated, and ultimately allowed the cover-up of the details of the Laquan McDonald shooting. The third thing we need to commit ourselves to in reform is to force the Chicago Police Department to figure out how to restore trust in all of the communities it serves, all of the communities it serves. The city last fall committed to create community oversight of the police department. A number of community groups are working on community-driven proposals that will be presented to the city council this summer or fall. We support their work, and we ask you to do that as well. None of us in this room are naive. You all know how the city of Chicago works. Reform, to state the obvious, will take years to complete. It's going to take longer than a single mayor or the current members of the city council. The optimal opportunity for reform, as I've said, is a consent decree. However, until such time as we can secure such a decree, it is up to us, the citizens, advocacy groups, communities, to push for reform that assures that every community, every person in this city has the benefit of lawful, constitutional community policing. In Dr. Martin Luther King's speech in Memphis, the night before he was assassinated, almost 60 years ago, in the April of 1968, he appealed to the leaders of our land with a plea. All we say to America is, quote, be true to what you said on paper, referencing the aspirations of our Constitution. So, the ACLU remains vigilant in our mission of getting government agencies, including the police, to live up to the promise of our Constitution and to be true to what we, the people, said on paper. So I hope that you, each of you, will act in concert with the ACLU and other advocacy groups and community groups to urge the leaders of the city of Chicago to continue to move toward real police reform. That is the only way that we can assure a safe and prosperous and constitutionally run city. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jack, and thank you, Colleen. Tough lady, right? It's because her 92-year-old mother still lives in North Dakota all through the winter. Unbelievable. Great. Thank you so much, Colleen, and I see we have a lot of questions. This is from Charlie Gardner, who's a trustee at Roosevelt University. He'd like to know what the ACLU's position is on gun control.
Okay. So, historically, the ACLU's policy on gun control reflected what the Supreme Court had said prior to the decision in Heller, namely that the text and the historical documents of the Constitutional Convention looked at gun rights in the context of a militia, a state militia. Obviously, Heller happened, and the ACLU's position on gun control is essentially we see that there can be, I think, meaningful controls placed on the purchase and use of guns, and we do think that it is that gun use and gun ownership is also linked to the high levels of violence that we see in the city of Chicago. But you all are as familiar as I am with how the courts are regarding those efforts, I think common sense efforts to restrict the ownership and use of guns. And so I think for the time being, we have to continue to use other creative strategies to solve crimes.
Okay, very good. We have plenty of questions, Colleen. This is from Bird Hoffman with Castlewood Homes. What can the average citizen do to help protect our civil liberties?
A lot. And I think that you're starting here, and as I said to Ed at lunch, I think that one of the silver linings of the results of the November of 2016 elections has been a surge, not just in ACLU membership, but in citizen engagement. Democracy cannot be a spectator sport. We all have a responsibility to stand up and be informed and get involved and to remind our elected officials, who also have a hard job to do, of their responsibilities, including their responsibility to conform to the rule of law. And so I think that the most important thing people can do is to be informed, stay involved as a citizen, and I'm going to say, and give generously as you can to advocacy groups. And I'm not just up here saying support the ACLU. The city of Chicago is blessed with a number of really terrific public interest groups, both advocacy and direct social services groups. And the budget impasse, which I think also has created or contributed to the spike of violence that we have seen in the city as social service programs and crime prevention and diversion programs and violence reduction programs have been eviscerated, quite frankly. All of those nonprofits and agencies really need your support as we continue for now almost two full years to be without a state budget.
Good. Thank you. We have plenty of questions here. And by the way, my admonition to print seems to have borne fruit. I think there's only one that's handwritten. This is from Rebecca Levin, who's with the Ann and Robert Lurie Children's Hospital.
How do you respond to the claim that the new requirement for police officers to complete a form after stopping someone is somehow responsible for the increase in shootings and homicides?
I reject it emphatically and unequivocally. It's just plain flat out not true what some people have said, namely that it takes 40 minutes to fill out one of these forms. It doesn't take even half that long. And some of the information that's on that form was not requested by the ACLU in its settlement with the city of Chicago. So conforming to the law does not prevent effective crime fighting. And we have to really ask ourselves if we want a police department that is really defending itself by saying that if we comply with the Constitution, if we comply with the law of the land, we can't do effective policing. I reject that, and it's not just the ACLU rejecting that. When you look at what's happened in other cities that have used the now discredited stop and frisk, broken windows type of policing strategies, for example, New York, they have not seen the similar spike in violence that the city of Chicago has seen. I think that spike in violence really reflects, as the Department of Justice found, the complete breakdown of relationships between the Chicago Police Department and the communities it serves, and has nothing to do with asking that Chicago police officers comply with the standards of the Fourth Amendment. You basically have to have reasonable suspicion or probable cause to stop and frisk somebody on the street.
Great. Okay, this one we're going to go to law school. Okay. Kathy Miller, the interim executive director of the Constitutional Rights Foundation. Will ACLU file an amicus brief when the Seventh Circuit opinion in Hively versus Ivy Tech concerning the extension of Title VII protections to sexual orientation is appealed to the Supreme Court? I said we're going to law school.
We're going to law school. Glad I've already been there. Thank you, Kathy. Yes, I think it's quite certain that the ACLU will file an amicus brief if, as is rumored to be the case, the Supreme Court ultimately takes up that case. But as you know, that case was decided just last week, and what the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals held is that discrimination against people on the basis of their sexual orientation is sex discrimination that is actionable under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Okay, this is from Jack Thornton. Jack's up here. He's wearing the tie with the American flag. Very nice. And he's was a member of our staff, but he's leaving to go on to other things. He ran our database and so on. So, Jack, good luck to you. Where does the ACLU stand on corporate campaign giving, Citizens United, and so on?
The ACLU strongly believes that what we need in the area of campaign financing is complete transparency and reporting, which unfortunately the court, not only in Citizens United, but in cases that came after it, I think has rejected. I think that these are very important issues that are affecting this country, and I'll quote Justice Brandeis that a little bit of sunshine is the best disinfectant, and I think that goes for campaign financing too, particularly for corporations.
Great. This is from Dave Lundy with Aileron over there.
Okay.
President Trump represents a target-rich environment for the ACLU. How do you decide when to get involved and when not to get involved?
Well, my son, who's an officer in the Marine Corps, would appreciate the target-rich analogy. The decision on whether to get involved or not to get involved is a really hard one, because even with the the influx of members and the influx of resources, we can't provide legal assistance to everybody who asks for it and everyone who needs it. And so we try to prioritize by looking for the kind of cases that we think will allow us to do the most good for the most people. And so the office here in Chicago has really prioritized doing class-based impact litigation, hence our efforts to reform the Chicago Police Department and many of our actions against certain state agencies, the Department of Children and Family Services, the Department of Health and Human Services. We're really trying to seek reform on behalf of thousands of vulnerable people. And then we have our core issues that are found, you know, in the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, reproductive freedom, voting rights. And in other words, as my staff have been wont to say, I don't like it when they say no when I want them to do something. So we try to do just as much as we possibly can. And that should really be a terrific, I think, shout out to so many of my colleagues who are here today, nearly all of whom have basically been working around the clock since November 9th. I think collectively we are turning in 7-day weeks and not many weekends these days. So keep those questions and requests for help coming.
That was a question that was asked by several people, mm-hmm. including Denise McGowan-Tracy, which I think you just answered, how you prioritize and all that. So thank you for submitting that question. Mm-hmm. Now, we have a number of questions here relating to law enforcement.
Okay.
Dr. Bruce Handler, Ted Manuel, and Alias. How much do you believe merit promotion of change of command and change of command factors into CPD culture as far as leadership, accountability, training policy? Tied into that, can any longtime insider promoted to the top ever affect a change in police culture? And do you believe CPD reform would help curb violence in Chicago?
So, first, on the command and promotion structure, the Department of Justice report actually dealt with that. And again, this is one of the areas in which I think the Chicago Police Department is failing its own officers quite profoundly. Most officers really don't trust the promotion system. They worry that it's not merit based. They worry that it's not fair. And so I think that when you have that kind of distrust within the ranks for their own system of promotion, you have a very flawed system that does not even enjoy the confidence of its own rank and file. I think that the question of reform from within is a really difficult one to answer, and it's particularly hard to answer with any degree of complete absoluteness, because ever the optimist, I would hesitate to say that there is no one in the Chicago Police Department that is capable of reform. In fact, what we have found in years of litigating against the Chicago Police Department, what the Department of Justice report also found, was that there are, of course, many, many fine officers in the Chicago Police Department. But those officers are also, again, failed by a system that makes real reform from inside difficult, if not impossible. One of the saddest problems that has been documented by some excellent reporting by the Chicago news media has been the whistleblower suit that two officers brought against the Chicago Police Department involving the way in which they were essentially ostracized, threatened, and ultimately driven out of the department when they tried to report a drug running racket that was operated by Chicago police officers in public housing, the public housing that used to run down the stretch. I think it was the Robert Taylor Homes ran down the stretch of the Dan Ryan. those officers, those whistleblowers, talked about that wall of silence, that code of silence that I talked about earlier, and how it was impossible for them to actually submit a claim of police misconduct and have it be taken seriously and investigated seriously by the Chicago Police Department hierarchy. And in fact, that same hierarchy actually, you know, allowed itself to be turned against these officers. That case was settled recently by the Chicago Police Department in the city of Chicago. When the federal judge directed the mayor to submit to a deposition about the code of silence that the mayor had specifically referenced in the press conference that he did after the Laquan McDonald video was released publicly. So there are tremendous obstacles to reform coming from the inside. But there might be that knight or in shining armor somewhere in there. So, you know, I never want to say never. But again, this underscores why the loss of the Department of Justice as a partner, why Jeff Sessions' retreat from the letter of intent and the indication that they'd go forward with a consent decree is so problematic, because a federal consent decree overseen and supervised by an independent federal judge is the best way to assure meaningful reform.
Thank you, Colleen. Let's give her a big hand.